Hey everybody, this is Miko Hughes letting all of you know that my friends over at the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast are reviewing the movie Pet Sematary, so what are you waiting for? Go download it now.
Recording live from the Black Lodge, it's me, the free will burning head turning ass kicking machismo dripping master podcast and mouthpiece of the Southeast, Brandon A. Lane, bringing you a new edition of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. Hey ho, let's go. Hey ho, let's go down to the Pet Sematary. But I gotta tell you, I'm kinda scared to take this journey on my own. That's why I've recruited the efforts of the gentleman you heard at the top of this episode. Everybody's favorite piece of roadkill, Gage Creed himself, the legendary child actor and all-around great guy, Miko Hughes. I want all of you out there in the Rant Army to jump on board and track him down on social media. You can find him on Twitter at Miko Hughes. There's no excuse not to be following him, and there's certainly no excuse not to be following us. So what are you waiting for? Find us on Twitter at Rants Black Lodge, same thing with Facebook. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean, Player FM, iHeartRadio, and don't forget to stop by our homepage at JuicyKruger.com. What are we here for tonight? I'm pretty sure you've inferred that by now. We're going to be doing a full-length feature commentary for the 1989 Stephen King classic Pet Sematary. But first, gotta hear some messages from our sponsors.
Next Generation Wrestling brings some of the most talked about and star-studded professional wrestlers from around the world. Based out of East Tennessee, NGW is becoming one of the most sought-after independent wrestling promotions in the past 4 years. Witness NGW Live or on demand on the High Spots Wrestling Network streaming app. Follow us on social media platforms at NextGenTN.
Hey assholes, it's me, Boner the Skeleton, mascot of the Rants from the Black Lodge podcast. Here to sell you some shit you probably can't afford. Are you low on cash? That's not a problem. Sell your children. Sell your blood. Go to the jack-off clinic and give them a sperm sample. We don't care how you get the money, as long as you give it to us. Want a t-shirt? Want a sticker or a mug to show that you're a true friend and a member of the Rant Army? Well, guess what? Go to Rant Army Surplus. The link is in the description. And if you don't buy something, then fuck you!
I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. Just want to live my life again.
How you doing, Bonnie Lassiter?
Oh, no.
Nobody's going to get that reference. Teddy Flippin' Travis might. It's his mother. If you know what I mean.
It's his legit mother.
No joke. There's no joke there. I like to have coitus with her. All right. Sitting to my left. You know him. You love him. Stank Dick. Stank Dick. Stank Dick. Stank Dick. Stank Dick. Eddie.
Hey.
You haven't been on the podcast in a while. What was the last episode you did?
Dude, I don't remember. I think it's when we did Suburban Commando.
Oh, yeah. Suburban Commando. Well, I think by all accounts, this is a movie that is much better.
Yes.
But you and I, when we very first met, we had a commonality bond on Halloween 6.
Because I had the producer's cut.
Because you had the producer's cut. But I think the first real in-depth conversation you and I ever had about a horror movie was about Pet Sematary and about a specific character that we'll get to later on in the movie.
Still.
Oh, yeah. So, as always, if you want to watch along, I mean, you don't have to, you get to, you can cue your DVD you know, whatever Blu-ray or whatever copy you may have, we're watching on DVD, slumming it. I do have it on Blu-ray, but we're going old school 480, motherfuckers.
Oh God, you can tell too, just already. You can tell.
It adds to the aesthetic of the old schoolness. But if you want to watch along, by all means, you'll just you'll crank it up, get it to right as the stars are going to be going up around the Paramount logo. But as always, you don't have to watch along. You get to watch along. So if you just want to listen to our nonsense and just listen along. All right, on the count of three, when I say hit play, you're going to hit play. 3, 2, 1, play. All right, Pet Sematary was released in theaters on April 21st, 1989. It had a budget of $11.5 million. That's estimated. I'm sure there were some nickels and dimes in there not accounted for. Its gross, domestic gross here in the United States, was $57,469,100. Hold on, let me say that again. $57,469,179. So yeah, it turned a fairly good profit.
Especially for that time.
Oh yeah, this was a definite runaway hit. IMDb ranks it at a 6.6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes has it at a 52%, which I don't agree
with that.
Honestly, I thought this would be much higher, but after doing some research, this is much more of a divisive film than I ever really thought it was. The audience score, 59%, so, I mean, they're pretty much torn on it between critics and audience. But Google users, which tend to always be the most accurate to how I respond to a film, they came through once again with a score of 89%. That sound a little more accurate to you?
I think it's in between. Like, I feel like I'd say if you gave it like a 75.
We'll argue the points as we go along, because I think there's things both positive and negative about this movie. This movie, with our Fat Tony's hit list has 7 kills, 8 if you include Lewis Creed's kill, which is
ambiguous.
Is inferred because, you know, Rachel comes back from the grave and
spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler. If you're watching this before, listen to our commentary before you watch the movie, then you're full of duty. This has an average kill, a kill every 12.88 minutes, so I mean it's not the most blood splattered movie of the time, but I think this movie was kind of harkening back to the more of the, you know, scary woods aesthetic, you know, slow burn. But it definitely
the movies
has
that we like.
Yeah, I mean, I love splatter movies and slasher movies too. But this was definitely atypical of the time. I mean, this is the height of the boom of slasher movies, or maybe they're, you know, starting the plateau.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Friday the 13th Part 8 came out in this year, and did Halloween 5 come out in
89?
Yep, mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got that, you know, that plateau of those types of movies, but this is definitely a throwback to a more gothic, I guess it would be like a northeastern gothic kind of tale. So, Stank Dick Eddie, on the titty tally, what we got for Pet Sematary?
Extremely disappointed, because the last couple of movies I've done, there have not been any titties.
Yeah, whereas every movie that we have done without you there have been a plethora of boobies present, and I don't know what it is.
Conspiracy is what it is.
You're not living up to your name. I'm attributing these titties to your name in name only. So we're definitely going to have to find a movie down the line to really exploit your titty prowess. Live up to that name. Stank Dick.
I agree. I'm at the top of my head, I can't think of any titty-filled movies other than when you all did Reanimator.
Yeah, there were quite a few. And it was actually so many that it was hard to keep track of how many boobs there were. But man, I'll tell you this right now. The star of that movie was that big swinging dick you see. You know, flopping.
I fucking watched it. And I was like, that's the meaty fucking hanger they're talking about.
Before we can really get into the movie, we've got to talk about the book. Have you ever read the book?
When I was younger, I think I was probably like in maybe 6th or 7th grade. I started to read it and just I never finished it.
Most of King's classic works I've read, this is, I would probably put in the, you know, probably top 5 or 6 books that I've read from Stephen King that actually affected me. I read this in, I maybe was in 8th grade. It was before I went to high school, but I'm pretty sure I was in 8th grade. and, you know, primed and ready to be, you know, like, oh, I'm too old to be scared by something. But Stephen King has a way of writing things that really digs under your skin. And I mean, the guy could, you know, could write a paragraph or a page about, you know, what a pencil looks like. So when he describes things, it really has a way of working itself into you in a really visceral way. And I know we're going to get into this a little later, but as a parent, as we see Miko Hughes, the, you know, who it's nice enough to give us an intro for this episode, really little kid during the filming of this. As a parent, I'm asking you because I don't have any kids, how impactful is this now as opposed to when you first saw this?
I mean, when I saw it, I mean, I was real little. My mom used to always tell me stories how I actually had the same shoes that Gage wears in this movie, which would have put me about the same age as Gage in this movie.
Wow.
Close to it. And so my mom hated it, but it's tough, man. Even when they showed the trailer for the newest movie, and then they revealed that it was the daughter that gets hit.
Yeah, that actually may be a spoiler because some people have not seen it. But
oh, they showed it in the trailer.
Well,
and as you know, my daughter, she's the older of the two, and they're very close in age. I think she was supposed to be like 7 or 8, and Kaylin's about to turn 6. So, I mean, it's a scary thing to think about. When you're younger, you watch this. You don't put yourself in the perspective of the parent. But once you do, I mean, you can imagine what that would be like to go through, and it's scary. That's what makes this, to me, as an adult, scarier now than it was when I was a kid.
I mean, I guess empathize from the point of view that, like, a lot of my friends have children. I'm kind of like a surrogate uncle in some regards. Fat fuck Scott's kids. I beat the shit out of them all the time. Disciplining them because he fucking won't. but I mean, I can understand the impactfulness. But the root of all this, I mean, it comes from the novel. And Pet Sematary, the novel, was published on November 15th, 1983. So, pretty quick turnaround from book to film, you know, roughly, you know, 5 years. It was published by Doubleday. King was teaching at a university in Maine, and he was, like, had a residency on the campus. And there was a busy road that they lived next to. And his daughter, I guess had a cat, and I'm blanking on the name of it. It was Twinksy or something like that. I apologize. I really should have wrote that down. But of course the cat got ran over, and he was affected by this from having to explain death to a child, which is, I mean, death is sort of an abstract concept in a lot of ways, even in just in reality, because, you know, what is
death?
You know what I mean? Like, it's hard to explain. Like, it's like going to sleep, but forever.
Yeah.
So you're explaining that to a kid, and it's a hard thing to get around. So he starts, like, warping this in his mind. Like, well, what if it had been her or a child that had been ran over? And he starts cultivating this idea so much so that he writes it, and it fucked with him so much that he put it away. And he was like, nah, I can't do that. And I guess his wife found the manuscript. He's like, no, you've got to publish this. And, you know, it got out into the world, and obviously it, you know, spurred a lot of great things, a sequel and a remake. But
How do you feel about the sequel?
We'll get to that a little later. Actually, I have a question about it, and I have a lot to say about it. The inspiration for this story, on top of, you know, the real life aspect, came from a short story from W.W. Jacobs called "The Monkey's Paw." I'm sure you're familiar with it. You know, the monkey's paw. You wish upon it, and one of its fingers closes in, and of course, you know, there's like a macabre backdraft to all the horrible things that occur from it. You know, be careful what you wish for, you just might get it. And that's kind of the aspect of really any morality tale, you know, going back to EC Comics and a lot of King's work, you know, well-intentioned people making bad decisions out of, you know, a bad situation. There are a lot of differences between the novel and the book. The book contains a lot of sex, but it wasn't included in this. You know,
damn it! I know.
But let's do a titty tally on the book. I need you to go through there and like find out every time there's an exposed breast.
Every time I read, I'm gonna just send you a voice message. Tits. Like again, I'm like I haven't had time to read all of them.
I know what I'm getting you for your birthday. Judd's wife Norma isn't in the film, and she is kind of the I'm blanking on the character's name, but the their housekeeper that finds out she has cancer.
Oh yes, I can't think of her name. Millie.
Yeah, oh, I've got it in my notes. Later on, we'll get to her. But the catalyst for Judd telling Lewis the story about the whole pet cemetery is from Norma dying, and. Well, the cat, but you know what I mean. Yeah. There's some differences in the from that aspect. The spirit from the Native American lore called the Wendigo, not in the film. It's sort of implied in one part, but I mean it's very very vague. There's the character I was talking about. The reanimated church in the book is way less violent, more like instinctual. It's not fucking with Lewis Creed and. The dog that comes back from Judd Crandall's when you know that previous years prior to that he had reanimated comes back more as like a dumb oaf rather than just this vicious animal, and it makes a lot more sense in the book, I guess, as to why, like, hey, I'm gonna have you know take your cat and bring it back to life if it's going to be a little more.
That's kind of a plot, like a fell in this movie, if you kind of think about it.
Yeah.
Because he already knows what's going to happen when he brings his dog back.
If you break it down, it's like basically Judd Crandall's like, hey, here's this thing that you shouldn't do, and I'm going to tell you how to do it, and then I'm going to warn you not to do it again.
And then I'm going to make you do it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, watch you do it.
It's pretty convoluted. Instead of Missy is her name.
Missy.
Instead of Missy committing suicide, Judd's wife Norma dies. Just mentioned that. And the movie, Gage is chasing a kite in the movie. He's running away from Lewis, when he's hit by the truck. Gage is torn and decomposed. I mean, like really fucked up in the book, and he's in incredibly good shape for a kid that got completely mauled by a truck in the movie. I think there's a story to this, and I may be misquoting, but they tried to do makeup on him, like to get a cast of his face, but he was a really little kid.
He's only like, two?
Yeah, two, like maybe that. Three. I think he was like 33 months, however many that ends up being, but roughly, you know, almost two and a half, three. But, you know, you can't do that on a fucking kid, and so basically they did what makeup they could on him to make him look scary, but I think he does the part pretty well, considering he's a little kid.
Yeah, that's
very memorable.
That's the thing that a lot of people don't realize too, is like most kids in that situation have a twin or something like that. And I mean, I know you're probably gonna get to that, but
we'll definitely be talking about that. But I mean, I before we even jump into it, all you have to do is look at him, and how could you not cast this kid into a movie? He may be the, you know, top five, or if not, you know, maybe the most adorable little kid in a movie ever, and it just makes him all the cuter because he has such a tragic befalling in this story, you know, that you know, you're already emotionally engaged with him by the time the shit goes down. I mean, look at him, adorable. Before we can really talk about anything else, we've got to expound on the person who made all this possible, and that's Stephen King. Are you a Stephen King fan?
Yes. I'm more. It's a tough situation because a lot of like his books are a little bit different than his movies. As a younger kid, I read some of his books, but I've seen a lot more of his movies than read his books.
One of my all-time favorite books is Misery. I mean, I love the movie as well, but that's probably the Stephen King book I've read the most, and I've said this previously on the podcast. The scariest book I've ever read is it. That's why I've been probably more harsh on the adaptations of it than other people who don't know the source material as well. I am looking forward to the sequel. I'll watch it, but Yeah, it should have been a TV show. And man, there's a lot of really good, really fucking dark stuff in that book that just didn't end up in the movie. Stephen King, obviously, let's just run down the things he's known for. Carrie, Salem's Lot, which you
both and I are good,
big friends of. The Shining, The Stand, The Dead Zone, Firestarter, Cujo, The Running Man. He wrote that under a pseudonym, Richard Bachner, as he did Thinner, but they're just pseudonyms. He was at that point where he was trying to test the fact, like, could I literally write anything?
And
when people would buy it. And he wrote it under pseudonyms. Basically, it's just a reaffirmation. It's like, am I as good as I think I am? And he fucking is. Cujo. Christine. Great movie. Cycle the Werewolf, which was adapted into Silver Bullet. Great fucking movie. It. Misery. The Dark Half. Needful Things. Gerald's Game. Dolores Claiborne. Another really good underrated movie. Insomnia. The Green Mile. Cell. Now let's just go down the fucking long, long thing of fucking short stories.
I was about to say, you missed one important one.
Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption, which of course was adapted into The Shawshank Redemption. At Pupil, The Body, which was adapted into Stand By Me. Great fucking movie. In fact, Fat Fuck Scott's wife is she is illiterate in the ways of film.
Yeah.
And we have been compiling this list for Fat Fuck Shot to Scott show his wife, and one of the later editions, it just popped in there. It's like, oh my god, you have to add Stand By Me on there.
And she's never seen it.
She's there. How have you never seen Stand By
this
Me?
This list that we came up with, we already have, what, like 20 or something, 20 or 30 movies?
Oh.
Like, right off the bat?
I think the list ended up being around 50 plus. And
Shawshank was on there, on mine as well.
How can you not have Shawshank Redemption on there? I mean, that is such a great story, and it's something that, like, probably a misconception that all of Stephen King's books are horror stories, when in reality, I mean, he has a pretty wide net of things he's written about. The Green Mile, which, I mean, it has a supernatural element to it, but it's still,
a
great movie, uplifting story to it. He's won 15 Bram Stoker Awards, 6 British Fantasy Awards, 5 Locus Awards, 5 World Fantasy Awards. Now, I could explain to you in depth what those mean, but I would be spending a lot of time on something that it probably, in the grand scheme, isn't very important, because, what are awards? But it just goes to show you that this isn't a niche thing. Everybody reads Stephen King, and you gotta just understand that he really is the king of horror, at least in this generation. He's had some acting stuff. I mean, you see him in Creepshow. He's got a cameo in this film later on during the funeral scene. Pretty hard to miss him. Goofy looking guy. Just being honest. Coke bottle glasses, kind of a unibrow, Now, in Stephen King's writing and in his films, he tends to ride the rails of things that are... He tends to tread the same waters over and over again. You ever seen Pascal getting carted in? So, I would like this to be the inaugural edition of a new segment. So, let's... let me get my vocal cords ready. Let's choke on some horror movie cliches in this new segment called Trope On It. It came out more like The Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, that's fine.
I was trying to do Joe Pilato from Day of the Dead. choke on it. Okay. So, this is the list. There's 20 on here, and we're going to tally up how many of these are applicable to this film, and we'll give it a score based off that, and we'll kind of figure out, is this the ultimate Stephen King story by way of the things he likes to talk about, or is this something more unique to his writing category? All right, child has psychic powers. It's not expressly indicated, but Ellie Creed does have nightmares,
premonitions.
So we'll give her that one. Character has a medical condition. Obviously, Zelda, which we're going to talk a lot about.
Still,
Spinal meningitis, I believe, is what she has. So that's a check for that one. Story takes place in Maine. Yes, it does. Now, here's the other cachet to this. Bonus if it's in Castle Rock or Derry. Doesn't take place in either. Now, in the book, they make reference that it is in proximity to, I believe, one or the other. It also makes a reference to Cujo, but that's not applicable to the film. Rural setting hides horrible secrets. That's a big yes. Antagonist with no redeeming qualities. Here's an interesting thing about this movie. There really isn't an antagonist.
You said that was it the Wendigo?
Well,
yes and no. Yeah, I mean, it's implied, but not really.
But really, the antagonism of the film is their own anguish. It's the wanting to right of a wrong. Okay, Lewis Creed is a character. He's a doctor. He has a stance of like almost wanting to intervene with the inevitable, which is death. So, I really, if you break it down, the story is that you can extend someone's life, but you can't continue it. You know, death is inevitable. So, I guess if you wanted to break it down, death is the antagonist of the film.
Yeah.
Death has no redeeming qualities, but I'm not going to give it to it because that's a crock. Character makes racist comment. I watched the movie twice, thinking, like, maybe I'm missing one, but no, there's none in here. Now, definitely in Stand By Me and It, you hear some, but not in this one.
Is there even a black character in this movie?
There may be some at the school in the background, but no main characters. Overzealous religious character, which is another hallmark of King's writing, and there doesn't seem to be, Stephen King himself does play the character of the priest at the funeral, but he's not there to, you know, push his beliefs down your throat, and they don't paint them in a entirely negative light. Abusive parents. This is a point I will argue that is told better in the book, but not so much in the movie. But Rachel's parents. There's definite friction between he and Rachel's parents because he doesn't go when they have a trip, and he kind of low-key states, you know,
that they don't like him.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give it to that because especially during the Gage's funeral, I mean, they get into a fucking fist fight.
If you look at it, though, he moved them away from her, so that's kind of could be one of the kind of things deep in within it, you know.
But I'm gonna give it to that one because although the film probably lacks in explaining that, it's definitely there. Animals dying. That's a big yes. Flashbacks. Yes, there are some flashbacks.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Character is or was an alcoholic. No. There's no express. You do see Judd sitting on his porch drinking beer, but that's just an old, you know, that's country dad.
That's what you did.
Yeah. I mean, shit, what else he got to do? Sit on the porch and drink beer. Reference to another King story. Now, I mentioned before that in the book it references Cujo, but nothing in this film, so can't do that one. Internal monologue. You maybe could argue that Pascal serves as an internal monologue, but there's no like narration, noir kind of narration in the film, so that's not applicable. Word or phrase is repeated. Almost, but not quite. Sociologist used to give plot details, nothing like that in this film. Stephen King cameo, bullseye. Yes. Brutal bullies. None in the movie. And wise older character who helps main character. Well, that's well, I guess maybe you could argue that he does more to hurt him, but, you know, Judd Crandall. How can you hate Judd Crandall?
I never realized this, but he's wearing Dr. Scrubs to sleep. I never noticed that until now.
He's busy, dude. You're sleeping scrubs. They feel good. They breathe. Like maybe it would air your stank dick out of you. So let's number this up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 out of 20. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this is probably atypical of a lot of Stephen King stories, and maybe that's why it's so personal to him and the story that he says has affected him more than any other story he's ever written. I mean, would you, just, I mean, from the movie standpoint, like, put this up against a lot of the other Stephen King stories? It really does feel independent of them.
Yeah. It, like you said, there's really not a main antagonist in this movie, in which I feel like, you know, in Christine, there was the car, you know, yeah. And, you know, and it's Pennywise. And this, like you said, it's death, which is, if you think about it, it's even darker than what you would get with a, you know, a clown.
Stephen King has a tendency to overwrite villains and make them really, really interesting. Annie Wilkes, Carrie, which, you know, the difference between the book and the movie are vast. But, yeah, it's an interesting direction to take where, you know, there really isn't a clear-cut villain. Okay, we started out this episode singing. I think that's a good transition just to point out that how important music is in the backbone of this film. The composer of this film is named Elliot Goldenthal. He did Cocaine Cowboys, Drugstore Cowboy, and evidently has a thing for cowboy movies. Neither one of those are really cowboy movies. Alien 3 with Sigourney Weaver, who's in Ghostbusters. Boom. Just got busted. Demolition Man, Interview with a Vampire, Cobb, great baseball movie about that racist Ty Cobb. Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. That's a pretty big leap in quality. Heat, great movie, Michael Mann. Time to Kill, Sphere, Frida, which he won an Oscar for Best Score, and Across the Universe. Reportedly, he nearly died in 2005 from a double hematoma. He was leaning back in a chair in his kitchen, and he fell backwards, and he smashed his head on the floor. Well, he was in a coma for a while, and he spent months in therapy trying to regain his ability to speak. But we don't fucking care about that. The only thing about music anybody cares about this movie is the Ramones.
That's so fucked up. Oh my god. I mean, hey man, you almost died. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, no one cares about you. We only care about the Ramones. That is fucked up, but it's kind of true. When you associate this movie with music, the first thing that comes to your mind
is the Ramones. It's on, I think, 3 or 4 of my playlists on Spotify.
Well, obviously the song is Pet Sematary. It's from their album Brain Drain. It made it to number 4 on the U.S. alternative Billboard charts. I guess you kind of tend to think of like punk as being this sort of relic from the 70s. But for whatever reason, the Ramones were able to stay relevant over and over again throughout the years through constant lineup shifts and you know, drugs and inner turmoil with the band. And it's kind of an interesting story how this song was even written. Stephen King, the Ramones were playing in Maine. Stephen King is a huge Ramones fan. He's just a huge rock fan in general. Well, he invited the band over to his home. You know, like, you're going to turn down an opportunity to hang out with Stephen King. And they went and hung out, and he started telling them about this book that he had written, Pet Sematary. And I guess it inspired them so much, they went down in the basement, like a half an hour, and came out with the lyrics. And that's pretty much how the song was birthed, you know, half an hour.
Well, like you were just saying, you wondered how the Ramones were able to stay relevant like that. That's why.
Yeah, they're able to just crank, you know, the inspiration strikes and they're able to hit the ground running. The song was nominated for a Razzie Award for Worst Original Song in 1989. That's absolute bullshit.
Yeah, it's a good song. I mean, it gives you plot points to the movie, but it's a good song. Yeah, I like it.
I don't know how. I can't remember offhand like what other would have been in contention in 1989 for worst song. But I'll tell you, I'm a huge Prince fan, but I can tell you right off the bat, fucking Bat Dance from the Batman 89 soundtrack, probably a worse song than the Ramones' Pet Sematary.
I'd say also No Holds Barred.
Oh my god, no, you shut your mouth. That's a great song. No Holds Barred! It all comes back. It all comes back.
Always.
Okay, this movie was directed by Mary Lambert. She's predominantly known as a music video director. Prior to this, she had done stuff with Sheila E., but a lot of stuff with Madonna, Chris Isaak, The Eurythmics, Janet Jackson, Rod Stewart, Queensryche, love them, been on stage with them. That's a story for another time. Sting worked with Bobby Brown, who was in Ghostbusters 2, just got busted again! Whitney Houston, Motley Crue. Her other weird claim to fame is that she directed the FMV game, which is full motion video. There were a lot of those for like Sega CD, Sega Saturn.
Way ahead of its time.
Yeah, if you say so. a game called Double Shift or Double something like that. Double Shift, Double Switch was what it was called. And it's not as infamous as Night Trap, but it is one of the catalysts for the reasons why we have the ESRB now. So you can pretty much thank Mary Lambert and Corey Haim for some small reason why you have ratings on video games now. Yay, thanks a lot, assholes. she also directed Pet Sematary 2, which
we'll I did not know she did. She actually was director of that.
Yes, she was brought back on board. She did Urban Legends Bloody Mary, which is like the third film in that series. And more recently, she did Mega Python versus Gatoroid, which I have to imagine is probably the best thing she's ever done.
We need to review that one.
The production of this movie was kind of an interesting one from page to screen. There was a writer's strike, and it took them... This movie would have been made a lot quicker, even though the turnaround was pretty fast. But originally, Stephen King wanted George Romero to direct this, and...
Could you only imagine how different this movie would have been?
I think, in some regard, it would probably... Visually, I think this movie would be better, but I think the heart of this movie, coming from a female perspective, like, especially the stuff with the kid getting run over, I think there's just touches with her directing style that add a lot to the weight of the moments, like the heart of the story.
Yeah.
Tom Savini was reportedly offered the chance to direct the film as well, and he turned it down. And not long after this, he would go on to direct the 1990 remake of...
Underrated.
Super underrated. Great movie.
I'm glad we come to grips on this, because that's such a good remake.
For years... I would see that movie on, like, TNT, like, Joe Monster Ball.
Vision. Yeah, that's where I first saw it.
And as a kid, like, I was convinced that was Jamie Lee Curtis.
I can understand it, because of her haircut.
Yeah. She was very, very True Lies era mm-hmm. Jamie Lee Curtis. And when I finally got a copy of it, you know, maybe, like, the late 90s on VHS, because we're old.
Yeah, I bought it on VHS as well.
I realized, like, oh, this is not Jamie Lee Curtis. I'd also convinced myself that it was Night of the Living Dead 3, even though that is not a thing. So, be that as it may, I was a stupid kid. We didn't have the internet back then. It was a lot harder to know things about movies. You know, you watched them and you enjoyed them and you hoped eventually that you would be thumbing through a TV guide or whatever and see that one of them would be on.
Like, the closest thing you'd have to that really would have been, like, Fangoria, just to even let you know.
That's true. I subscribed to Fangoria for the longest time, but it was much later after that. You know, I'm in, like, high school, because my parents were not about to let me subscribe to anything. My grandmother had a WCW magazine subscription, and, yeah,
exactly. Thanks a lot, Goldberg.
If you haven't heard me tell the story before, my grandmother realized that my grandmother is horribly racist, and she realized that Bill Goldberg, the wrestler, you know, Goldberg, was Jewish, and forbade me from having it. She's an awful person. I don't associate with her anymore. That's beside the point. So, how old were you when you first saw this movie?
I was young. We've talked about it in the past. I've watched horror movies for as long as I can remember, because, I mean, you've met my brother. He's 13 years older than me. So, I mean,
I know I can tell by looking at him. Awkward silence.
No, I will say, like, I watched this movie, you know, that's probably 4 or 5, man. Like, and that's why, to me, when we get to what we're going to get to, it stuck with me. It's the same reason why I always tell you about The Exorcist. When I saw The Exorcist as a kid, it stuck with me. Even as an adult now, it still sticks with me. This movie sticks with me because of that one character. Plus, it's a good movie overall to me. I think it's a quality movie. But you know, I was probably about four or five.
I can't really pinpoint how old I was when I first saw this movie. I can tell you unequivocally, however, that the first time I saw it was on TNT. And it wasn't on MonsterVision, but it was like a super late Friday or Saturday night. And I'm like flipping through the channels, and something about it caught my eye. And I remember having trouble going to sleep after the fact. So it is something that has definitely lasted with me over the years. Did you have pets growing up?
Did. When I was younger, my sister always had cats, and my brother always had a dog. So much so, one of their dogs got a hold of my sister's cat, and we found it. And so, but yeah, we actually lived by, like, in a duplex, and right out, you know, there, one of the main roads was right out there. So, I mean, you used to see cats and stuff all the time. So, yeah.
I have had pets intermittently throughout my life, but by and large, you know, my parents just didn't want, you know, a cat or a dog or anything. So whatever we had was for brief times. So I've never had that, like, super emotional bond with an animal. But I know from experience from people that I know who have pets that the death of a pet is almost as, you know, shaking as the death of a relative. I'd hate to really compare it to, like, the death of a child. Yeah. But I mean, it is emotionally investing in, you know, for vexing for people. I know, like, the old adage is that you don't want to work with children or pets in a movie. Dale Midkiff, who plays Lewis Creed, said that he didn't have any issues working with Gage. Evidently, he was just super easy to work with. But the fucking cats, you know, they had a whole bunch of them to try and get, you know, the performance out of them, and, you know, whether it was them to get them to eat something or what have you. Here's our flashback, by the way.
Yeah, these flashbacks are actually one of my favorite parts of the movie, especially later on when he mentions the son that got buried up there. Yeah. I love that when we get to that.
By the way, this dog is named Spot. That is a very, very on-the-nose reference to the Munsters. You know, Fred Wynn, obviously, coming from that story. Let's talk about Dale Midkiff as Lewis Creed. For years, another thing, because we didn't have the internet, I got him confused with Tim Daly from Wings.
I can see it, though.
For the longest time. And I would tell people, like, you know, oh man, everybody from Wings ends up in horror movies, you know, because blah, blah, blah is in this, and the other guy, whose name I'm blanking on, is in the remake of The Shining. And,
yeah. The one that, like, the ABC one or whatever.
Yeah. That's a terrible movie, by the way. He's good in it, but it's a terrible movie.
It's funny you mentioned that, because every time I think of him, there's it was a made-for-TV movie that he was in with the chick from Facts of Life, and it came out the same year as this. And they actually made laws about calling the cops on spousal abuse because of this woman, what happened to her. But he plays the, like, abusive husband, and he literally slits her throat in the middle of a road, like, out, like, in an intersection.
Okay, when you're saying he, pronouns, pal.
Sorry about
are you referring to...
He plays that character.
Dale Midkiff.
Yes.
Okay, well, I don't know what movie that is, but put it in your Google machine. You'll figure it out.
Yeah, but it was long after the fact. I'm like, hey, I'm like, that's Lewis Creed. I'm like, why is he slitting this chick's throat?
Who was it from Facts of Life? Was it Tootie?
No, the
was it the one that looks like a fucking Garbage Pail Kid?
the one that was like the tomboy.
Joe.
Joe, yes.
Yeah.
I always think Family Guys.
Blair was the hot one.
Yeah.
Joe was the one that would probably, like, change the muffler on your on your car.
And then try to get your girlfriend's phone number.
I'm cool with that. She's probably better at it than I am. Dale Midkiff was in Nightmare Weekend, kind of a throwaway horror movie. He was in Casual Sex with Leah Thompson, though. That's a pretty good movie. He was in Love Potion Number 9 with Sandra Bullock. 43 time tracks. That was a show, evidently, that was somewhat popular and never heard of it, but that's a relic of its time. It was in The Crow Salvation, Alien Fury, Countdown to Invasion, with WWF's China.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it either. Air Bud 3, which is obviously the best of all the Air Bud movies.
Hold on. No. With the fucking clown. Is that the first one?
No, fucking fight me. Fight me. Which one of the... You tell me right now, unequivocally, that there is a movie better than Air Bud 3 in the Air Bud cinematic universe. I'm pretty sure he plays hockey in this one.
He plays football. He's a wide receiver.
No, I'm pretty... No, it's Golden Retriever, and that's part two. It may not be. It may be part three. I don't know. That's not the point.
Oh, man.
He was in Route 666 with Lou Diamond Phillips. Goddamn right he was. And Flight of the Living Dead, which is snakes on a plane, but instead of snakes, it's zombies. No Samuel Jackson.
I was looking up his IMDb stuff as well, and I saw that he was on an episode of Dexter, and I cannot think of where he was at on Dexter. But I know it's Rachel. Rachel is also on Dexter, because that's Dexter's first kill.
Yes, Denise Crosby, yes. In fact, I'm going to say one more thing about Dale Midkiff, and we'll go right along to her. Do you know who was first considered to play the role of Lewis Creed?
Who?
Bruce motherfucking Campbell.
Oh my God.
That would have been a completely different movie. Listen, I think Bruce has the acting chops, but our perception of him has been marred by...
Ash. He's Ash. Like, you can't look at Bruce and not think Ash.
He's the perfect smartass. He's the Bill Murray of the B movie world, you know. And to have him in this really heartfelt story, even though like he probably would have done a terrific job, I think it would have been hard for people to accept him. By the way, we're getting to see.
Yeah, like, is this their basement? Is it implied it's their basement?
If it is,
so what a bitch to do this in her basement.
That's a pretty fucking thing.
It looks like it, right? Like,
by the way, earlier, Lewis,
sorry, Missy.
Yeah, Lewis offers to take a look at her because he's a fucking doctor, and she's like, "It'll pass."
This is her way of that. It looks awful now. Sorry, it looked terrible now.
It's hard to get a hanging effect correct.
What was that shot even for?
I don't know.
There's Stephen King.
Look at him. His fucking Coke bottle glasses and his unibrow. He got hit by a car one time. That's a true story. They actually turned it into a comic book. I suggest if any of you out there who are comic book fans, seek it out because it's terrific. It's one of the most unintentionally hilarious things you'll ever read about the harrowing tale of somebody legitimately thinking that their life and perhaps career were over because they were hit by a car. Stephen King, everybody. All right, Denise Crosby. She was in 10 with Dudley Moore. And Bo Derek, really great movie. She was in Trail of the Pink Panther and Curse of the Pink Panther. The best, the less said about those films, the better. 48 Hours with Eddie Murphy, who was in Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd, who was in Ghostbusters. Says it's fucking triple threat. You just got busted. She was in Eliminators, Dolly Dearest, which is a really underrated.
Yeah, that's a good movie actually.
It's sort of in the vein of Child's Play.
That's a girl doll, isn't it?
It is a girl doll. There's a lot of movies that came out around that time. You know, there's Child's Play, Dolls, Dolly Dearest. They're all very similar. She was in 13 episodes of Key West. She was in Jackie Brown and Deep Impact. And more recently, she was in 15 episodes of Ray Donovan. But let's just be honest. The thing that we all know her for is playing the role of Tasha Yar on 31 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. She jumped on board, figuratively and literally, the USS Enterprise. And she was so convinced that the show was going to flop that she found a loophole and got off the show. Well, by the third season, it was like the biggest thing on TV. So she literally has screwed herself out of 7 seasons and 4 feature films of
royalties
and upfront money. And by the 6th and 7th season, I mean, they were all making a boatload of money. However, her leaving the show probably made the show better because it gave a couple of underdeveloped characters time to shine. They did bring her back after the fact to play super convoluted sci-fi stuff of a daughter, the daughter of herself from a different dimension who is a Romulan, and it's awesome. She has a weird family tree. She is the granddaughter of Bing Crosby, as in, you know,
White Christmas?
Yeah, yeah. Singing with David Bowie, you know, Little Drummer Boy type stuff. And at one point, Blake Edwards' daughter-in-law. That's how she got the role in the Pink Panther movies that she was in. She is the niece of Harry Crosby, who was Bill in the first Friday the 13th. He's the guy that gets the arrow through the, you know, he's one that's pinned to the door.
Yep, when Pamela's chasing her.
And she's a distant cousin of Seth MacFarlane from Family Guy.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, everybody is connected in one way or another, but, oh, Jesus.
This is it, guys.
Okay.
Goosebumps. Literally goosebumps right now.
Is Zelda, who is played by Andrew...
He killed this role, man.
Hubert Sick. I'm probably butchering that name. Is Zelda the scariest thing ever in a movie?
It's up there, man. Because, dude, like, you can't watch this and not be fucking terrified.
I mean, I legit have chills.
Yeah, dude, like, seriously. Like, I'm getting in. Like, I'm thinking back as a kid when my sister and my brother used to scare the shit out of me, man. And the thing is... It's a real thing.
Yeah, it's all too real, and I think that's what adds a dimension to it that would be absent if it was just, you know, supernatural nonsense or whatever. Obviously, Zelda is female, but they couldn't find any a woman emaciated enough to fill the role, and they found this guy, Andrew Hubert Sick, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing the name. Hasn't really acted a lot, so this is pretty much the claim to fame.
Look at him act with his eyes, too, man. That's awesome. Ugh. That is terrifying.
Yeah, for years, I mean, after I said that I watched this on TNT, this is the reason I couldn't go to sleep. I just had these thoughts of a kid or a person in a room adjacent to me calling out for me, and
Rachel!
Yeah, it just, oh my god, it just fucked with me so bad. She was in, or he rather, see the child convincing yeah. was in Blue Steel with Jamie Lee Curtis, who's in Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd. That's four times you've just been busted. Oh, all right, let's go back to Denise Crosby. One last thing I want to point in. I think the first thing I ever saw from her, and I didn't even realize this till years later, but she is in a Black Sabbath music video called No Stranger to Love. That is a weird period in Black Sabbath's history where technically that album isn't a Black Sabbath album, but it is a Black Sabbath album. So it's called Black Sabbath featuring Tony Iommi, and that's when they had Glenn Hughes as their singer, and he played like four concerts, and he got fucking punched in the nose because he's horribly on drugs, and he had caked blood in his throat, and he couldn't sing, but he's the greatest living singer, and I fucking met him, and he's a good guy, and he's off drugs, and he had a heart attack one time. It's been fucking wild ride, man, but she was in that music video.
And like I said, she was Dexter's first kill.
She was Dexter's first kill.
Because she was the nurse that was feeding Harry
medicine. Too much medicine.
Yeah.
Kind of playing the whole mercy, like I'm going to...
Kevorkian.
Yeah, I'm going to make you sicker and fuck. We're about to...
Get real.
Yeah.
We were saying this before. It's been a while since I've watched this movie, and my son just turned 4. And to me, I feel like he's very reminiscent to Miko in this movie. Like I see Finn in him, and dude, I don't know if I could handle something like this happening to my kids.
By the way, Sheena is a punk rocker from the Ramones, playing in the truck stereo. And I guess the guy had trouble like singing along to it, so they're actually piping the music in a like an earpiece for him, and he's doing a really bad job of lip syncing, or he's not, he's actually singing along with it, but he's, you know, he's keeping in time because, you know, he's white. Oh man. You have to think though, like, if they've had all these issues with
the road, put a fence up or something, yeah. You know, like, that's Kalen. That's spot on, little brat.
Oh man, this is hard because they paint such a pretty picture of just a happy family, and you know they have their grandfather surrogate, you know, saying wise things as their paper plates blow away. You know, did they not ever think, like, maybe we should put up a fucking fence?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, like...
I mean, you're a fucking doctor. You gotta be making some money. Although, I think, isn't he interning?
I think, yeah.
Or he's a he's taking a residency, which I guess is, like, I don't know. And, bam. And all you see is a kite flailing and, shoes, and a little shoe. Truthfully, though, that's probably more effective than actually seeing a kid, you know, getting demolished. Oh, that's hard. Okay.
God, man.
Fred Gwynn.
Thank you.
As Judd Crandall. He started off his career, you know, back in the 50s. He was in 60 episodes of Car 54, Where Are You? One of the better shows of that time. He was in Harvey with Jimmy Stewart. He was in The Boy Who Could Fly, which was a personal favorite film of mine growing up, Fred Savage.
Yep.
The Secret of My Success, Michael J. Fox.
Underrated.
Underrated, great, yeah. Michael J. Fox, man.
He was pumping out hits, dude.
I often wonder, like, how different things would have been. Because, you know, he was still acting on television.
Spin City?
Yeah. But, you know, he had done The Frighteners, and...
Yeah, oh, that's such a good movie, too, yeah, man. Yeah,
we gotta do that sometime. Fred Gwynn was in Fatal Attraction. My Cousin Vinny, great
movie. Oh my god, he's awesome in that movie, too.
But he was best known as Herman Munster in 72 episodes of The Munsters. Let's debate it right now. Eternal question. This is a make-or-break, friendship kind of thing. Munsters, Addams Family.
To be honest with you, growing up, I never really watched Addams Family. I always watched The Munsters. Because Munsters was always on Nick at Night.
Yes.
So I'd always have... When it comes to movies, I mean, the Munster movies were not that great. I'd go with the Addams Family movies. But when it comes to the TV show, The Munsters was my shit.
Man, we're pretty much eye-to-eye on this. I had such a fucking crush on Vivian DiCarlo growing up. I've always had a thing for weird goth chicks, even before like there was a definition for it. Yeah, pointing at my Elvira stand-up. But like, no, I knew Vivian DiCarlo before I ever knew Elvira. And I don't know, there's just something spooky and sexy about her. But I have a funny story about Fred Gwynn. Not specifically about him, but our good friend, Honky Tonk Matt, shout out from Von Grimm Productions. He and I worked in a full-time, year-round haunted house. And one day he decided, like, fuck it, I'm going to be Herman Munster. So he put on a Frankenstein monster prosthetic, painted himself gray. And I realized that Herman is supposed to be green, but back in the day, you know, he painted himself in black and white.
Yeah.
And he would jump up and down and go, it was the funniest thing I've ever seen, but it scared the shit out of people because he was so overzealous happy with it. Oh, great. If, and this is a little deterring from Fred Gwynn, but if you were at a funeral and a fist fight broke out, would that, how would you feel like if, like, you know, God forbid, you know, that's your kid laying right there, and you get into a fucking fist fight at the funeral of your child?
Oh, man, I can't even grasp it. I can't even grasp it. Like,
you know, like, it's easy to throw up something on screen that is like a guy getting their head chopped off, or, you know, a guy in their dreams who slashes teenagers. But for me, something like that, especially now that I'm an adult, affects me a lot more than it did when I was a kid. Like, just the idea that, like, somebody would get into a fight. Because being an adult, you come to realize that, like, no one really grows up, and, like, petty shit just lingers.
Yeah.
And my dad's side of the family, that's exactly what would fucking happen.
Well, I had an aunt pass away a few years ago, and the tension was like that. Not to the point where someone's going to punch someone, but you'd feel it. You know what I mean? Like, just the tension.
Yeah. We live in a strange, strange world. Fred Gwynn was under consideration for a role in Punky Brewster and went in for casting call and all that. But the casting director referred to him accidentally as Herman Munster, and he got angry about it and stormed out.
Yeah, everything I've ever heard, he loved playing Herman Munster, but he felt like it ruined his career because that's what he got kind of like typecast as Herman Munster.
He had a good sense of humor about it, but like, you know, when it impeded him from getting work, he...
Well, wasn't he like a classically trained actor as well?
Yeah, he did a lot of stage plays and stuff. He's actually a Harvard graduate from, you know, 1951. So he's Ivy League, trained, did a lot of stage work, radio work back in the day. Mary Lambert said that the role of Jug Crandall, like, Fred Gwynn was her one and only choice. Like there was nobody that she felt like could have that grandfatherly feel that the role needed. Now, he looks pretty old in this movie, but it's sort of deceptive because he actually had jet black hair and he colored his hair white to make himself look older. But, you know, he pretty much, he had that jet black hair his whole life. Kind of like my grandfather. You know, he had, you know, crooner hair till he died, and he was like 93, and you know, perfect beautiful hair.
This is coming up here is actually my favorite scene I was telling you about, where they have the flashback of the
basically the foreshadowing of why you don't take a body. You know, the soldier who came back, I believe it's like, isn't it Vietnam?
Yeah.
Or Vietnam or Korea, whichever one. And he came back and it was not quite the same. In the book, when Gage is reanimated, supposedly he is possessed by the spirits, the evil incarnated version spirits of Zelda and the army, the fella who got reanimated. I'm blanking on the character's name. But yeah, there's a lot more elaboration in that, whereas in the movie he's just a little shit that, you know, cuts people's Achilles tendon.
Oh.
Yeah. Hard to watch. Okay, Herman Munster was ranked number 19 in TV Guide's list of the 50 greatest TV dads of all time in 2004. I think that's more than deserved. Even though his scene has passed, we'll get to see him pop up intermittently through the movie, and that is sort of the soothsayer, the character who warns of the foreboding nature of the story, and that's the character of Victor Pascal, played by Brad Rehnquist. This guy has been in some awesome stuff. He was in Mutants in Paradise, which I know it's a movie that most people out there probably have never seen. Find it. Shudder. You don't have this on there right now, but please, Jesus, fucking dig this up, because I will watch it probably 20 times. I haven't seen it in the longest.
Shout out to Darcy the Mail Girl.
Yes, shout out to Darcy the Mail Girl. We've had some interaction with her on Twitter. We mentioned that last month on the podcast, but man, it never gets old. Thinking about Diana Prince, and yeah, here's that guy ripping his fucking face to shreds. Ugh. Brad Rehnquist was in Loose Cannons with Dan Aykroyd, who was in Ghostbusters. He just got busted for 5 fucking times! Ugh! That's so much busting, it makes me feel good. He was in Stephen King's Golden Years. He was in Ali with Will Smith. He was in The Lone Ranger with Johnny Depp, and the least we say about that, the better. Annabelle Creation, better than the first one, but still not a good movie. He's done a bunch of TV work. He was in Star Trek Enterprise, Nash Bridges, Grimm, Bones, CSI Miami, he's NCIS, place, Heroes, Medium, ER, 6 Feet Under, That's My Bush.
God, I forgot about that show.
From the creators of South Park.
Oh, that was such a good show, I forgot about it.
One of the things that Pascal, or Victor, I'm sorry, Brad Rehnquist as Victor Pascal had to deal with was when they would cut for lunch or whatever, like, he felt that, like, people treated him differently because his makeup was so horrific, and he felt ostracized, like, people would not sit next to him and socialize with him. So that goes to show you, like, how subliminal, like, things like that, like, I mean, you could probably get into an argument or a discussion about class distinction and subsects of society, but how just a little, you know, a little head wound can ostracize you from everybody. Ellie Creed was played by Blaise Berdahl, and she's done a bunch of stuff as well. One of the better little kid actors of the time. There's some lines in this movie where she feels really, really real. And, I mean, that's probably not indicative of the whole movie because there are some lines that seem forced. But her reactions to some things, like we were talking a little earlier, you were equating her to your daughter, Kaylin. Yeah, she has some of those kind of like snooty, yeah, bratty kind of moments. She had trouble crying in the movie, and Mary Lambert was trying, like, everything to get her to emote, but she just couldn't get her to cry on command. So finally she's like, listen, I will pay you more money if you cry. And evidently that worked. So despite the fact that Mary Lambert, you know, maybe not have the best visual eye, she definitely had a way with working with the cast and crew to get, you know, the best performance out of everybody.
And you were saying, it's really noticeable that a woman directed this movie, because I look at it that she's looking at this movie in the mindset of a parent.
Yeah.
You can feel that.
Yeah. And like we said before, with the whole aspect of if George Romero had directed this, I don't know that that kind of aspect would be present. But my biggest problem with the aesthetic of the movie, it looks really flat. There are parts that it looks like something that was shot for TV.
Yeah, it looks like a TV movie to me. Yeah, I agree
and,
with that.
George Romero could have, you know, really put the pizzazz in the aesthetic part of it. Blaise was nominated for a Young Artist Award in 1990 for her role in Pet Sematary, and again in 1992 for her role in Ghost Rider. Not Ghost Rider, as in the
Nick Cage.
The spirit of vengeance that rides a motorcycle. No, Ghost Rider, which is a ghost that helps children solve mysteries. I didn't know this fucking existed. That is the stupidest premise for a story I've ever heard. PBS, you've done it again.
It's not Wishbone.
She was in We're Back in Dinosaur Story, 74 episodes of Ghost Rider, which I just mentioned, 7 episodes of DC Super Friends as Cheetah, smaller roles in Celebrity Deathmatch, that's a relic of the past.
Really?
Yeah. One Life to Live, and Are You Afraid of the Dark, which
I love evidently Are You Afraid of the Dark.
It's coming back. They're going to do a new series.
Well, 90s is back, and I think All That's back on, too.
Yeah. I won't go down the rabbit hole of Nickelodeon and their pedophile rings,
yes,
and all that.
Fuck you, Dan Schneider. Pervert.
Fuck you! Blaze's sister, Bo, also plays Ellie in some shots. I didn't mention this earlier. We kind of touched on it, but most of the times when you have children, because of work restrictions, you get twins. That way you don't have to interrupt filming because you can continue with that. Well, in Blaze's case, they fucking loved her, and she just happened to have a twin. And Bo has not done really anything acting wise, so this is pretty much her claim to fame. But it's funny, like if you watch in the credits at the end, she's listed as Ellie 2, like Roman numeral 2. So I couldn't really point out to you what scenes is which.
I could have swore they said like she had like one of her front teeth were missing, like she lost one of her her front teeth. That's why you don't see her very often.
Maybe. I mean, I just watched the great documentary.
It was awesome.
It's on Shudder, and a lot of streaming services for free.
It's on Tubi as well, I believe.
Yeah, it is. So I really, really recommend that. Now, with the case of Miko Hughes, who plays the adorable child Gage, they saw this kid and they said,
"That's him.
That's him. We we'll work around whatever limitations we have. He stole the hearts of like the casting director and Mary Lambert. Everybody who saw him said, no, he's the kid. And I think they absolutely made the right choice. Miko Hughes, to me, is the definitive child actor of the 90s who didn't end up becoming a complete fuck-up.
Yeah.
Because he has clear of all
he
that.
He got out of acting like at the perfect time and realized, I can't do this forever kind of deal.
He was in Kindergarten Cop, which was directed by Ryman, who directed Ghostbusters 6 times! That may be a record for this podcast. You just got busted. He was in Cops and Robbersons with Chevy Chase. Who was in Caddyshack with Bill Murray. He was in Ghostbusters. Oh, 7 times! He was in New Nightmare, which I think we're all in agreement is...
it was way ahead of its time.
Top 3 of the Nightmare on Elm Street.
1, 3, and New Nightmare.
I won't even get into the minutia about it. That's pretty straightforward, at least from a critical and fan consensus. 12 episodes of Full House. He was one of Michelle Tanner's,
I thought so.
Reoccurring friends. Apollo 13, great movie. Zeus and Roxanne with Steve Guttenberg, so, you know, he wasn't turning down roles. Steve Guttenberg was a draw then, I'm just giving you shit. He was in Spawn. Which was a big deal at the time and kind of falling into, you know, better left in the 90s kind of mentality. Mercury Rising, which is a good movie with Bruce Willis, back when Bruce Willis gave half a shit about, you know, acting. 34 episodes of Life with Louie, a really, really good animated show for Fox Kids back in the day.
With Louie Anderson. I think I've seen that.
Oh, whatever. You don't even know. You kid. Tropical Thunder. Everybody loves Tropical Thunder. Great movie. He was nominated for a Young Artist Award in 1990 for his role in Pet Sematary. He was nominated for a Saturn Award for Best Performance by a Young Actor in 1995 for his role in Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
He was great in that.
Terrific. Really, really good. Was the youngest guest to be interviewed on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. I mean, he was really, really young. And when I was doing my research for this, I found the clip, and he's so little sitting in the chair, like he can barely see over the armrest to see Johnny. But how cool is that? I mean, we both grew up in generally the same time frame, and maybe younger people don't realize how big a deal Johnny Carson was, because maybe they grew up in Leno and now.
Well, even that, I mean, with Letterman and stuff too. I mean, I think once you pass Letterman and Leno, I think now it's kind of like diluted a little bit.
Yeah, but Johnny Carson was the king of late night, and to have this kid on there, you know, which I'm sure they probably thought it was somewhat of a novelty. I'm going to interview this little kid, and he'll say funny things because he's a kid, but it's still an affirmation to, you know, I mean, the kid literally had something that made him stand out from everybody else around him. He's of Chickasaw Indian descent, and his name roughly translates to chief in that language. You know, looking at him, I would have never have made that connection, but, you know, I have Cherokee in my heritage, and so, I mean, it isn't like you could look at somebody and like, yeah, you're Native American, but that's kind of cool. He was 31 months old when production began on this. So I was a little off. I think I said 33. He may have been 33 months when they ended production. But, I mean, the definition of a baby. Missy, we kind of glossed over her earlier. Played by, I'm going to mess up this name, Susan Blomart. Plays the role of Missy Dandridge, the housekeeper of the Creeds. She was in Edward Scissorhands, Stay Tuned with John Ritter.
I love that
movie. Great movie. I actually don't own Stay Tuned. I need to add that to the collection. The Jerky Boys movie. She was in Mouse Hunt. 9 episodes of The Practice. 8 episodes of Law & Order. Kenzie. United 93. Doubt. 27 episodes of The Blacklist. And most recently, she was in John Wick 3.
I thought the DVD messed up for a second.
Oh.
She's in a lot of stuff as well.
Yeah, she is. When she was preparing for the role, she actually met with a psychiatrist to get into a better insight of a person who had become suicidal because of her cancer. So, albeit her role small, she took it really seriously. The funny aspect of this is that she went to a screening of the movie when it first came out with a bunch of fucking kids, and the part where she's standing up there forlorn, you know, saying her goodbyes and everything, getting ready to walk off and commit suicide. Collectively, a bunch of, like, college-age kids screamed out, "Jump, bitch!" Heartless. Heartless. All the same, that's pretty funny. She has a good sense of humor about it, but it's still nice to see that somebody had they took the role seriously. It seems like everybody in this movie, like,
well, we were talking about premonitions. This is kind of another premonition.
Mm. I have a fear of addicts that have like, you know, that pull down stairs. Oh, here's fucking Zelda.
Oh, fuck you, man. Dude, see, look. Like,
yeah,
It's the craziest thing is, man, for the longest time, I had no idea that was a man.
Oh, no. All. I mean, no, it's been in recent years that I realized that it was a man playing this role. And I'll be honest with you, if somebody had not told me, I would have gone probably the rest of my life just thinking this is one of the scariest women I've ever seen. That right there. No, that fuck. Right there.
Oh, God.
Oh, no. Gross. Gross, gross, tonight. Gross. There's some minor characters. Like, we'll gloss over these pretty quickly. Michael Lombard plays the role of Erwin Goldman. He was in some episodes of the Mary Tyler Moore Hour, which is not the Mary Tyler Moore show. I didn't think there was a difference, but there is. He was in Priestley's Honor with Jack Nicholson, Crocodile Dundee, Devil's Advocate, Rounders, The Thomas Crown Affair. Mara Clark plays the role of Marcy Charlton. She was in The Crucible with Daniel Day-Lewis. Madame Rose in the VCR versions of Clue and Clue 2 board game. Robbie Cass, who plays Steve Masterson, 51 episodes of Saint Elsewhere, Freddy Got Fingered, which I'll defend to my dying breath as being a genius film. He had some smaller roles in House, Ugly Betty, JAG, NYPD, Home Improvement, LA Law, The A-Team, and MASH. Mary Louise Wilson as Dory Goldman. These are obviously the family. Yeah. Best Little Whorehouse in Texas with Dolly and Bert. I saw Burt Reynolds. Actually, we both saw Burt Reynolds.
He did not look good
right before he died. Like, was it last year?
It's like around this time.
Oh, you're right. It was.
Yeah. Because he died about 3 months after that, didn't he?
It was pretty close.
He did not look good.
No.
He did not.
Rest in peace, Bandit. That picture of you on the bearskin rug that's one of my favorite pictures.
Also love him in Boogie Nights. I love him on Boogie Nights.
Our good friend Mick Strawn worked on Boogie Nights.
Shout out, Mick.
Shout out, Mick. By the way, Mick Strawn just moved down the road. He's living in Nashville now, so I don't think I'm going to be jumping the gun by saying we're definitely going to have him back on the podcast and maybe have some other projects in the work, so stay tuned for that. Liz Davies plays the girl in the infirmary. This is literally like blink and miss it. She played in Penny Dreadful, the movie, not the show, and she was in 46 episodes of Avenue 43, and I have no fucking clue what that is, so what does it matter? Let's talk real quick about the special effects. We'll talk about some general trivia, and then we've got a couple of questions to answer, and I think that's going to close us out because we're nearing the end. The effects in this movie were done by David Anderson. He worked on The Serpent and the Rainbow, Alien Nation, Shocker, which we were definitely going to do eventually. Young Guns 2, Men at Work, Death Becomes Her.
Love Men at Work.
Hot Shots Part 2, Three Musketeers, Batman Forever, Waterworld, The Nutty Professor, Spawn, Men in Black, which he won an Oscar for Best Makeup for. He also won an Oscar for The Nutty Professor and its sequel. So.
Jesus.
Yeah, this guy's legit. He was in the Dawn of the Dead remake, Cabin in the Woods, Star Trek Into Darkness, 13 episodes of Scream Queens, which is a dog shit show, fuck it, 11 episodes of American Horror Story, which is a mixed bag. His brother, Lance Anderson, is a special effects makeup designer. He also worked on this movie as well, so they're kind of like a package deal. But David is the one with all the accolades. Although, after watching the behind-the-scenes, the documentary about this, it seems to me that Lance did a lot of the stuff that maybe he should have been given a little more credit. But, you know, I don't make these decisions. Here's the thing. He grew up friends with Charlie Sheen. They went to high school together. Charlie Sheen was the best man at David's wedding. David is married to Heather Langenkamp from Nightmare on Elm Street. I want to issue a correction. For years, I believed this, and Fat Tony believed this, because we both separately and independently of each other have said this on the podcast before, that we both believed that she had been married to Kevin Yeager.
I thought that as well.
That's not true. It's not true. He actually proposed to her during the filming of this movie. Like, she came up, and they stayed in the hotel, and he popped the question, and they've been together ever since. So, congratulations. That's like 30 years. So, man.
It's impressive.
They're co-owners of AFX Studios. So, that's, you know, they work, they love, and whatever else together. They've got kids, so that's pretty fucking cool.
Which is kind of a cool tie-in because she worked on
New Nightmare
with Nico. Yeah.
So I think that she actually met him for the first time on this, and I believe that maybe that might have been the link in how he got that job.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so I might be wrong on that. I'm just reading between the lines. Couple of general trivia questions, or general trivia entries here. In 1997, BBC Radio 4 did a 6-part radio drama of Pet Sematary, really true to the book, and it was super well received. There were 7 blue British short-haired cats, and each one of them was trained to do a specific action for the camera. Filming them was a fucking nightmare. The burial grounds was constructed on an actual mountaintop. The tree that Ellie swings on towards the beginning of the film was not actually at that house. When they were scouting locations to film, they wanted the aesthetic of, you know, the perfect little white picket fence house. Even though they don't have a fence, it would have saved their fucking kid. But they wanted the nice, you know, gothic looking tree so they could hang a swing from it, and they couldn't find it. Well, finally, they're driving down the road and they see this tree out in a field. They paid to have it uprooted and buried in the front yard, just basically for, you know, 1 or 2 shots. But I mean, that's filmmaking. You have a vision and you want it executed, and those little details maybe don't matter a lot to some people, but I'm visualizing the movie without it, and it does lose something.
Go ahead.
Let's see. The original cut of the film didn't test very well with the executives, so it was edited down to a shorter length, and the ending was reshot to be a little more shocking. Originally, when Rachel shows back up, it's a little more ambiguous to what's happening, and so they reshot it, and there's a little more, she picks up the knife, and there's a little more sinister pop. Oh yeah, that goop coming out of her eye. Sexy. The interiors of the house were a set because the house, the actual house was too small to film in. They had a lot of trouble with the fucking house. The shots for Judd's house growing up, they like repainted it and stuff to make it look like disheveled and old. And then they needed some shots from the flashbacks. They had to restore it in the middle. It was just a big clusterfuck.
If you really want to know, when they talk about the whole you're going to come to the big explosion and all that stuff here soon with Judd's house on fire. What they did to around the house, remember, they built like a facade wall, like a fire-resistant wall between the actual house and the house that catches on fire. If you definitely say, if you watch the documentary, it's fucking awesome how they did it. Plus the weathering that you said did as well. It's awesome.
All right, let's get to some fan questions. The Ramones songs used in the movie are iconic. I agree with that. What are some of your favorite songs used in other horror movies? That comes from Allison Hunt.
It's funny because we were just talking about the Ramones. There is was it Sniff Glue? Is the song that they do in the House of a Thousand Corpses. It's a Ramones song. When I think of Ramones, I think that song.
The one that comes to mind off the top of my head is Wasp from Ghoulies 2, Screaming Till You Like It. Great fucking song. The video's awesome. Blackie Lawless and his fucking codpiece and the little ghoulie puppets.
Man Behind the Mask, Alice Cooper. Oh my God, I mean that's like...
Well, Dokken, you know, Dream Warriors.
Dream Warriors, ain't got a dream no more. Anything that Sammy Kerr does?
Oh, fuck yeah, the entire soundtrack of Trick or Treat. That's it. That's the end-all be-all of rock music tie-ins. Okay, this comes from a listener's son. His name is Weston Bridges. Hmm. Why does the little girl have dreams of bad things to come? Is she psychic? Well, we kind of touched on this a little bit before. In the book, it's a lot more identified and blatant, but it's a little more inferred in this. But yeah, Ellie has pretty much The Shining, which, you know, is a a cliche of his writing, and you know, the King multiverse. Everybody has some kind of
which you could almost look at it as that Pascal's her guardian angel.
It's funny that you bring that up, because when discussing his character with Mary Lambert, she told the actor that Pascal is sort of like the angel of the story. So,
I don't know if I can watch it, man. Oh, this is so tough. Oh, God.
This effect here, this is so well done. Look at that. I love... See, I mean, like, they did a little bit of makeup on him, but that kid got run over by a truck.
Yeah.
Could you ever tell?
Yeah, well, even in the remake, it's kind of the same deal. She actually has a little bit more. I mean, she's older, but yeah, it's still kind of a little unbelievable.
All right, this question comes from Jeremy Brown. Did you like Pet Sematary 2? He's fucking biting his neck. I think actually right there he's like, kiss him, give him a kiss on the neck, Gage.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's good stuff.
Did I like... Dude, if anything came out of Pet Sematary 2, it's Gus. I fucking love the character of Gus in Pet Sematary 2.
Well, Jeremy Brown says, not that it matters, but I hated it. You know what? I can remember the first time I saw Pet Sematary 2. It was on HBO. I was at my friend Travis's house. And no, not Titty Flipping Travis. This is a different Travis who probably also flips titties in his meantime. It seems to be a commonality of Travis's. But his fucking family was super lenient. Like, we used to stay up and watch Real Sex on HBO. Dude. Like, his stepdad did not give a fuck. So we're watching this because, like, we're like flipping through channels, and the first thing we see is fucking what is his name? Anthony Edwards?
Yeah, plays Edward Furlong's dad.
Yeah, and he's like getting fucking rode by this naked chick, and we're like, yeah, and she turns into a fucking dog, and like, what the fuck? That'll give me a weird boner.
Do I pet you?
Oh, yeah. Here's the problem with Pet Sematary 2. The narrative focus is on Edward Furlong and his mother, who was killed on a movie set. However, Gus and his fat stepson or whatever,
yeah,
and the mother who's obviously been beaten and stuff. I was so much more interested in that aspect of the movie than I was with Edward Furlong.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think the focus, if they had shifted it over to him, would have been better. Because I was a chubby kid. I could identify with
trying to get that success off T2.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Edward Furlong was, you know, hot shit back then. And look at him now. Now he's just shit.
He was a character. If you watch that movie, his character, I don't give a shit for his character. Yeah. I care about that whole other storyline a lot more. Absolutely.
I completely.
And the whole idea of that Ellie went crazy. Like, that was the storyline they kind of had with that when they were telling the ghost stories at the Pet Sematary.
But, you know, it was a big flop, and I think it's found its audience over time, but it's definitely not a cult classic. And I actually forgot to mention this, but I'm going to interject it real quick. The original cover of this movie, which the DVD is over here in the floor, there's a movie called Cemetery Man. It's a movie that, like, probably not going to find easily, but it's called Delamore Delamorte is its actual name, but in America it's called Cemetery Man. The artwork on that film, like the DVD cover, is the exact same cemetery scene. They've just
tweaked it a little
taken Church Cat out and
see, fucking everything. There's that premonition.
Yeah.
Oh, dude. This scene. I think this scene with Zelda scared me more than anything. Oh.
No.
Oh, fuck you.
Now, throughout the film, when they're at her parents' house, they have that creepy oil painting of Zelda as a child. Ooh, this is... fuck you.
Dude, no, dude.
But she's got this, like, velvet...
And Engage is...
And Engage is wearing it, like... First of all, like...
It's right here, isn't it?
Here. Oh my god. Don't dress your children like this. Like, this is child abuse. Oh, no. I don't know whose idea was to put them in this and the fucking top hat, but that adds such a sinister level to it. Oh my god. I brought you something, mommy. Ugh. Alright, this question comes from Mike Dalton. Female horror directors are more common these days than in previous years. In your opinion, how important is Mary Lambert to the history of female horror directors? Very, but she's by no means one of the best. I could argue that Catherine Bigelow did Near Dark probably a couple of years later. That is
such a good fucking movie.
Way better movie. And, I mean, she's gone on to become an Academy Award winner. She did The Hurt Locker. And she worked a lot with James Cameron on movies of his that weren't utter garbage, like Avatar. And later, James Cameron is a sore subject with me. Love him and I hate him. You know, like the Soska sisters, who are kind of a big deal now, like they cite Mary Lambert as being important. I mean, I can't take that away from them. You know, what inspired someone to get into a field, you know, I'm not a woman, so it's not for me to say, but I have to imagine that, like, if for no other reason than, I mean, she was one of the first really ones of note, even though, like, Slumber Party Massacre had female directors, like, that series, it just wasn't as common, and this was a big studio movie, or at least in, comparison to other things of the time, because, you know, this had somewhat of a budget, and it was backed by Paramount. So, I mean, what's your take on Mary Lambert?
I think this movie has a spot in history just because of that. But like you said, it has heart, but it doesn't have a lot of substance the way it's shot. Like, it's very flat.
You know, and that's kind of an interesting thing because she's a music video director.
Yeah.
And generally, their claim to fame is, like, really striking visuals. But I think that her strength is more on the, you know, the helping of the performances and the, you know, the motherly aspect. But, I mean, she did the Like a Prayer video with Madonna. Yeah. I mean, that's a really striking movie. I generally don't like it when music video directors end up directing horror movies or just movies in general. Michael Bay was a music video director and he doesn't understand actors at all. I mean, he knows how to do shot composition and blow shit up, but there's just something lost. So I think Mary Lambert had the potential to be a great director. I just don't know that she ever really came into her own and as far as like cinematic movies go.
I want to say too how you said like she kind of helped the actors help them out the scene, you know, bring them to life. I can't think of a whole lot of movies where in this I feel like everything's acted so well for it to be considered a horror movie.
Yeah, I can't really point to anybody in this movie who gives a bad performance.
I mean, I would say Rachel to me would probably be the least
Well, she had big titties. She didn't need to give a good.
That's true.
She should have fucking showed them.
She's a goddamn Crosby.
She should have fucking showed them. All right, this question comes from Jason Tuggle. Have you seen the remake? If so, what's your take on it? I have not seen it. You've seen it, if you want to sum it up.
A lot of people just immediately hated it. I mean, I talked about it earlier, which if you've seen the trailer, you know that it's Ellie that dies and not Gage. I didn't hate it. I didn't like it. It was just there. Like, it's like they're trying to capitalize on the name of it. The story was good. It was shot, like how you said, like, this is, we said this looks flat. It's shot opposite. But it's like you said when you saw the trailer, it's,
like, yeah,
jump scare.
The first time when the trailer debuted, I was actually kind of interested in it because I love John Lithgow.
I thought he was great in the movie.
So it had my attention, and then the trailer came out, and just the way it was cut made me think, like, this is going to be, you know, nothing but jump scares. And that's completely the opposite of what this movie is. I mean, for better or for worse, the things that work about this movie is that it's sort of like a, you know, you're slowly escalating the, you know.
It's a slow build, which we've talked about. A lot of these older movies get shit because, like, Hereditary gets shit. Exorcist, you know how I feel about that.
Listen, Hereditary and, like, a few years before that, The Witch, both absolutely tremendous films. That the acting in it was Oscar caliber, and I know people on both sides of the equation who absolutely love them and who absolutely hate them. And everybody's entitled to their opinion, but I find it more fulfilling when it's a story that, like, ramps up to something.
I
slasher movies. I love slasher movies. Friday the 13th is, like, you know, my second favorite thing in the world. But, you know, there's causality, you know. You gotta tell a story to justify those blood and guts, and I think Pet Sematary, you know, albeit, you know, lacking in some departments, like, you know, it does have atmosphere. Like, you can't deny it.
I will say tell you the only thing I enjoyed the most about the remake was I liked the ending more than I liked this ending, but that ending's even more ambiguous than this one.
No, I for one like ambiguity because your mind is far better at filling in the gaps than, or at least mine is sometimes, than things are actually end up written. This comes from Fat Tony. Do you think they effectively showcased the murderous kid with few shots they were able to get of him? That comes from Fat Tony. Listen, I'm sure it was hard to make that kid look menacing, but
he's a damn adorable kid.
But, you know, they did the point of, you know, having high shots to make him look, you know, lower to the ground, and the cutting of the Achilles tendon and
the biting of the neck.
However, there is a scene right here that may be one of the most comical things I've ever seen in a movie.
When he flies down.
Yeah, this didn't quite work, but I think overall the execution, you know, leaving it kind of bare bones rather than overstating it, probably worked to their advantage. And really, I mean, all this is just, this is haunted house stuff, man. I mean, and it's brightly lit. You know, if this movie, I guess I can't speak to the sequel or the remake because I haven't seen it, but I know how movies are made now. And this
darker.
It would have been dark. It would have been storming outside. And sometimes you don't need all that stuff. Sometimes
just, what you see in the light's scary and what you see in the dark.
Sometimes just a creepy, just an old house is creepy on its own. I've often said the reason The Exorcist is so effective is that it's not a creepy house. It's just a house. Like, you can identify with this. It's like, wow, this is a place like my aunt lives, you know? If that can happen to them, it can happen to me. Okay, this comes from Titty Flip and Travis. If someone cuts their dick off and buried it in sour ground, would it come back and slay the pussy?
That's an interesting question.
I think you're well qualified to answer this question. Or I don't know where to take it. You go.
Well, I mean, if you can bring back a kid who was clearly stitched together after getting hit by a Mack truck,
quote unquote,
I guess your dick could come back. I guess it could really be anything. I mean, anything that has a pulse. I mean, truthfully, if you think about it,
But would it...
Here it comes.
Would it or would it not be able to, quote-unquote, slay the pussy?
That you can tell it's a mannequin.
Whee!
You can tell it was a mannequin, but it was a creepy-looking fucking... Or like a...
Oh.
Like a dummy.
Speaking of which, as we're recording this, this is a Friday night. This very night we're recording is the debut of the new Child's Play film. I have not seen it.
I have not either.
Actually, I take that back. It was yesterday. Today's Saturday, isn't it?
Shit, yeah.
Fuck. It is. Yeah, anyways, it's
we
upon
work, us. We work a lot.
Yeah, we do. We do. But everything I've seen about it, man, it looks like shit. And I can't speak to the story, but I'm talking physically about the actual...
This right here, this would hit me hard.
If you were in this position...
Oh, man.
And you had to do it.
I would.
I'll be up front with you. Anybody out there... You have reanimated children. You need them killed. I have no problem killing your children. I am like, if this were Fat Fuck Scott's son, not only would I plug him in his neck, I'd fucking give him a DX crotch chop as he was dying. Last laugh, motherfucker. I love you, Cass. You little shit. No fair. Okay, this is another funny shot coming up.
Where he just stumbles.
Yeah, this is. Little kids getting hurt is funny.
Look at that, though. Like, that... To get that kid to act like that, that's incredible, man.
Yeah, it really is.
Wonder how long he had to sit there before he actually fell asleep.
Oh, man. That's
so rough, man. I just want to go home and, like, hug my kids.
All right, we got another question from Titty Flippin' Travis. When Pascal isn't warning people about the dangers associated with burying things, do you think he's spying on ladies and playing with his meaty ghost clackers?
Well, I look at him as a guardian angel, so no, Travis.
Oh,
the interesting thing, I always think it's really interesting with Travis is, Travis is our friend, but Travis has never really been in the horror movies. So I don't even know if Travis has ever seen this movie.
Probably not. I'll tell you what he has seen. He saw that leaked video of Ricochet plopping his butthole. Refute me, Travis. You sent it to our chat group. I didn't want to fucking see it.
I didn't watch it. But Touch and Tip Skip Shirt. He's like, there's nothing gay here. But this is what I was talking about, though, where they did the fire. That was actually like a wall that they built around an actual house. That's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good way of like executing effect in the area they needed it to be without, you know, destroying the actual house. Because there were people, that's actually someone's actual house.
The cool thing, too, was the house that they used for the Creed's house. The people that own that house then still own that house. They still live in that house, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. They're fucking old.
They are.
I wonder if Pascal watched them bang their meaty clackers. So the answer is yes. If I was Pascal, I mean, come on. I mean, like, there's only so much time you can dedicate
to
telling.
Could you imagine if this movie was a comedy? And this Pascal? He's like, I see what y'all are doing.
Oh, Jesus, they're burying people again. I'm going to get them out. Nah, 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 nah.
Where the fuck is the fucking fire department?
Evidently, there's like four people that live in this town, and none of them fucking care about the plight of the Creeds. All right, this comes from Ben Hopkins. What are your top five favorite Stephen King films?
Ooh, go ahead.
I'll go ahead. Carrie is my favorite. It's in my top 10 favorite movies of all time. It's probably the one instance where I can say the movie is better than the book, and that's all because of the streamlined way that Carrie is funneled. You know, she's more relatable in the book. She's fat, has pimples and stuff, so it's easier to like understand why she's ostracized. But man, in the movie, she's just, you know, I would bang Sissy Spacek now, knock her fucking bony hips into dust. She's not like fucking hot, but I'd do her. Shawshank Redemption. You can't argue with that.
I mean, that's probably it's in my top five.
Yeah, it is one of the best movies ever made. I'm gonna say Silver Bullet just because
Gary Busey and Corey Haim. I love Corey Haim
and his fucking wheelchair rocket. That's good stuff. Oh man. Stand By Me. It's perfect. I'm gonna go with the ringer. David Cronenberg's The Dead Zone. I love Christopher Walken. So it's a great story.
I would have to say. I mean, you didn't mention it, but I mean, it's one of my favorite directors. But Christine.
Oh yeah, John Carpenter, great movie.
Look at that.
Oh, you want another Dexter tie-in? The main character of that film is now a director, and he directed several episodes of Dexter.
That's crazy. Yeah. Oh, here comes the ending, guys. You're about to get some Ramones. So this is what the.
Yeah. So I mean. The ending like originally played out pretty much the same, but a little less violent intent, more ambiguous.
I agree with you. Most of those Stephen King films, but Christine's definitely up there. I do enjoy Misery, Shawshank.
God, I fucking forgot about Misery. Misery's so good.
Paul Newman is,
Paul Sheldon played by James Caan.
Thank you.
Whose son?
I'm your biggest fan.
Whose son was in one of our previous entries, Ready to Rumble?
Like I said, Christine. I do also enjoy Cujo. I mean, if you
Fuck no, fuck you, man. Cujo is a one scene movie. You get to see Danny Pintaro fucking accosted by a fucking dog,
and as a kid, it scared me. I mean, I don't really I don't consider The Shining a Stephen King movie just because they changed so much in that.
It's funny that you point that out because that's why it's not on my list. I mean, it's, as a film in of itself, it's still one of the most effective and horror Kubrick's films ever made.
If you look at a lot of his stuff, Kubrick's was a weird fucking guy on some of the stuff. There's a lot of weird things. I've, you know, rabbit holed some different things and, it's just some weird stuff because... his daughter was married to Anthony Bourdain, and then he's mysteriously...
You're thinking, that's fucking, Dario Argento.
That's what I'm thinking, yep, sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
That's a completely different...
Once again, that's also some weird shit to go down that hole.
Yeah, Asia Argento, she,
disregard all that.
Fuck. Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, that's pretty much it, guys. So let's just, you want to sum up real quick? Like, does this movie hold up from the time you're seeing it as a kid to now?
It does in a different way, just because being a parent.
It's a whole different
perspective of looking at this movie. Because as a kid, to me, you're talking about Cujo's kind of a one-shot thing.
Yeah.
To me, as a kid, it was like that with Zelda.
Yeah, well,
and to me when I was as growing, there's two things I always remember from this movie, and it is Victor Pascal and it's Zelda. And then of course, you know, older, you know, people now would probably think of Fred Gwynn as Judd because of South Park.
Oh my God, yeah. Don't go down that road.
Yeah.
Maybe it just goes to show you how far into the Americana and lexicon that it's extended itself. I mean, it's grown from, you know, small seeds into a big bloom. The movie has always been in rotation for me. I wouldn't put it, you know, as one of my all-time favorites, but it's definitely one I can pop in anytime and enjoy.
It's one of those movies too where it goes through really quick. Like it's a fast-paced movie almost. It's slow build, but I mean the duration of it goes by very quickly.
Well, speaking of going by really quickly, this experience is time to close it up, and we'll be back quickly next month. Follow us on Twitter at Rants Black Lodge. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and like, rate, and share those links. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, Podbean, Player FM, iHeartRadio, which is a newly absorbed platform for us. Don't forget to stop by our homepage at JuicyKruger.com. And there's also a link in the description. Go buy a fucking t-shirt. Otherwise, Boner, well, he won't like you so much.
Yeah, Boner.
If you don't like it, then fuck you. All right. For Stank Dick Eddie.
Hey.
I'm Brandon A. Lane, and we'll see you next month for our 2-year anniversary spectacular. Bye, everybody.
Bye.